I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, we have a conversation from the unreleased archives with Michael M. Hughes, author of Magic for the Resistance, Rituals and Spells for Change, just in time for the midterms. If you've heard stories in the past year or so about witches hexing Trump, well, that's part of Michael M. Hughes and his now famous Trump binding ritual. We talk about that, the book, and a little background into the anarchistic and egalitarian elements of occultism and magic on this edition of Parallax Views. After a myriad of technical difficulties, welcome to Parallax Views, Michael M. Hughes.
Hey, great to be here. And it was those all those chaos keck magicians that I think were threw a whammy on your equipment. That's my guess.
So you have this new book out, Magic for the Resistance, Rituals and Spells for Change. And a lot of my listeners may not be into the whole magic and occult scene, but you say in the book that you don't really need to believe in magic to find this book useful, and of course the book is aimed at people who want to use magic as a form of resistance in the Trump presidency. But why do you put that in there, that you know, you don't have to believe in this stuff for it to be useful?
Yeah, people have asked about that, and magic to me is a really kind of a broad subject, a broad practice. I mean, I've studied magic, I've studied New Thought and positive thinking, and I really see magic as a very multidimensional thing. I think if you do rituals and you believe in what you're doing, it can have remarkable effects in your life and in the external world. If you do rituals just because, let's say you do a ritual for something and you don't really believe in magic, it can still have remarkable effects. I mean, rituals themselves induce really interesting changes in our consciousness and our way of seeing the world. So I think if you believe in magic and you do rituals, I think you'll find that very, if you actually do it with intention, you may find that your belief in magic changes. But even if you look at it as just sort of a ritualistic self-affirmation of things that you believe in or changes that you want to occur, I think you can still have remarkable results by doing that. And as human beings, we've been doing rituals since the first, you know, proto-human picked up a stick and drew a little circle on the ground, or did a handprint in the darkness of a cave in the Paleolithic era. So we're hardwired for ritual. We're hardwired to respond to ritual. And I think it works even if you don't embrace a spiritual belief that there is such thing as magic. It still can have remarkable effects.
And it can be just a lot of fun and pranksterish too. It can be a way to upset the powers that be. And you know what? One of the things I really like about the book is how do I put this? A lot of people I know on the left always sort of try to place occultism as sort of this entirely right wing thing. I think Umberto Eco was one of the first people to do that, but in your book, you point out that there's a long tradition of, magic is sort of an anarchic thing rather than a hierarchical thing. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Magic is always sort of magic. You know, it's sort of a very liminal thing. It's on the boundary. It's always, magic is always sort of on the outskirts. You know, science berates it, religion berates it, but people. You know, we're sort of magical looking creatures, and whether even people who are deep advocates of reductionist materialism, they're prone to magical thinking too. You know, they have to kind of work hard to excise that from their thinking. And I think it's just as, the propensity to do ritual is very part of who we are. Magical thinking is also very much of who we are. And it's not always a negative thing. It's, it's often used pejoratively. Oh, that's just magical thinking. But actually magical thinking has positive benefits for us. As far as, people who have a religious or spiritual worldview tend to have better health. When we pray for somebody, it has effects on us, things like that. So, but magic, as in witchcraft or occultism, has always been a very marginal thing. It also is very anarchic, as you suggest. And I think it's always also been part of people who are marginalized, people who are on the outskirts of society. You know, the obvious example is the witch or the shaman who, doesn't live right in the village, but lives sort of in the wilder parts outside of the town. And so it is anarchic. It is very disruptive. It's liminal. It's a subject and it's a practice that really falls in the gray zone of, that people, it's shunned, but it also fascinates people. So it's, and there is a history, the history too of magic. A lot of people have this idea, because there have been, people who practice magic that are kind of right wingers. Julius Evola, in particular, there are lots of kind of right wing magicians. The magical community has always had a problem with that. But if you look back in history, you'll see that magic has always been a tool of the marginalized and the oppressed. Now, let's say you're a serf, in Dark Ages Europe. There's not really much you can do to elevate your stature in life. I mean, you're pretty much at the bottom of the ladder, sleeping in pig shit in your smoky, dirty hovel, and not much is really going to lift you up. You're living in a feudal society. Your stature in life is pretty much, it's pretty much the way it's going to be. So what can you do to influence your life or to get back at your evil landlord? You can turn to magic, and throughout history, in times of turmoil and crisis, people do turn to magic. And there are lots of examples I cover in my book, going back to European history, the witch Isabel Gowdy, really fascinating character, and she's someone who actually confessed to witchcraft and you know, killing people with elf arrows and meeting with the dark, dirty, hairy devil one night, and making a pact with him and all this stuff. And granted, you know, a lot of this is, you know, a lot of people believe she was just a disturbed person or something like that. When you look at historical accounts of witchcraft, it always has to be run through the lens of, you know, is this real? Was it coerced? How much of it is legitimate? That sort of thing. But it's fascinating that the tale is that she used witchcraft to get back at her landlord and the local priest in the town. By cursing them, cursing their offspring and things like that, allegedly because they were mistreating her, and she had no other way to fight back. And you also look at Haiti and the colonization, the European colonization of Haiti, and Haiti actually gained its independence through a movement that was largely fueled by Vodun or voodoo. And was a prime motivator of the insurrection that eventually turned that into the very first autonomous nation in the Caribbean. And as you look back through history, you know, I was doing the research. I knew some very famous examples of magic and witchcraft being used, you know, politically or as a resistance sort of thing. But I found so much more. And the more I dug, the more I realized this is like such a rich vein of history that really hasn't been mined that thoroughly by historians. But there's some really beautiful examples. One of the most famous was during World War II, when Gerald Gardner, who is essentially the creator, the father of modern witchcraft or Wicca, it could be an apocryphal tale. Historians argue about the historicity of it. And I've read so much about it, I tend to think that it did happen in some form. But it was called Operation Cone of Power, as Gardner called it and wrote about it. And this was in Britain, and apparently Gardner's coven did a ritual called the Cone of Power, and they did that to prevent Hitler from invading England. There was all sorts of fear that indeed there was a naval and aerial force that was massing to invade Britain. And according to Gardner, several of the witches who were very old actually died a few days or a few weeks after the ritual, and they knowingly expended the last of their energy, knowing that they might die to prevent Hitler from invading England. And around the same time, Dione Fortune, who's another famous occultist, she came out of the Golden Dawn magical tradition, and she had an organization called the Servants of Fraternity of the Inner Light, which later became the Servants of Light. And what she did, she basically said, okay, we're going to stop being secret about the training that we do in our order, which, like most magical orders at that time, were very, very secretive. She said, we're going to open this up because the danger from Hitler and the Nazis is so, so immense and so overwhelming, that we're going to open up the practices, our meditative practices, our magical practices. And what she did, because transportation was so difficult and cities were kind of, you know, under siege and bombed and things like that, is she sent out instructions, weekly instructions, to the people, and again, in her expanded circle of practitioners, because she opened it up. And what she did was send out, it was kind of like a social network, but through the postal mail. And she would send out instructions of meditations, of visualizations, of like angelic beings going up and down the coast to protect from the Nazis, and meditations and rituals and things like that. It's really fascinating. And it came to be called the Magical Battle of Britain. So there's so much of this stuff, you know, and it's not just European, it's transcultural. You had enslaved Africans in the U.S. who used hoodoo and conjure.
Root working.
Root working. Exactly. It goes by different names depending on the region and who practiced it. To get back at their oppressors. You know, these people literally had nothing, but yet they managed to take their African religious and magical belief systems and kind of marry them in a syncretic fashion with a Christianity that was being enforced upon them, and turn that magical system and use that magic in their resistance against the people who had enslaved them. So it's, you know, the more you dig, the more of this stuff is out there. And, you know, frankly, when I did the Trump binding spell, which led, you know, to everything that led to the writing of this book and the publication of this book, I knew a good bit about some of the more famous examples of magic being used politically or as a resistance tool. But there was so much that my eyes were opened up to, and it's just such a deep, interesting, fascinating subject.
And I that's a really interesting point that you said. Dione Fortune was trying to, you know, sort of open things up, because I think that's where this conception of magic or occultism being, you know, a right wing or hierarchical thing comes from. A lot of people think it's initiatory and therefore elitist, but I really like that you show there's another side that is much more egalitarian with it.
Yeah, well, Western magic has its own, you know, pedigree. It came from, you know, wealthy white guys that could afford to have the books and get stuff inscribed on, you know, silver talismans and things like that. And if you look back at the grimoires and the early Western magical texts, it is geared towards the wealthy. And a lot of it was done by the clergy, which is kind of fascinating too. But magic has always been egalitarian. And in fact, that's why it frightens conventional traditional religions. And because if you put the spiritual power in the hands of the people, that takes it away from the priests and the shamans and the chiefs and things like that. So, magic is, it's disruptive, and it's disruptive to all established systems. But it really has been part of the folk tradition, and there's lots of folk magic traditions, even among Catholics. You know, Catholics are, and it's easy to understand why, because I mean, if you're a Catholic, as I was when I was, you know, a kid, you're immersed in ritual and incense and, you know, the ringing of the bells and candles and all that stuff. So it's natural that that folk practitioners, you know, people who might have had Catholicism kind of forced upon them, still could find a way to, you know, to wiggle through that and do their own candle burning rituals, you know, maybe under the guise of the saints or the Holy Spirit or something like that. But there's always the folk magic tends to come through when cultures are conquered. Similar to the way in which Catholic saints are often appropriated in traditions like Vodun or Santeria or Apollo, things tend to merge and mix, and it's really hard to stomp out the desire to do your own sort of spiritual magic. But yeah, it's definitely a thing of the people, and I tried to make that very clear in the book, that magic is the technology that humans have always had and used, no matter what the authorities tell them that they should be doing.
Yeah, and I mean I like you highlight so many great things, you know, especially with the hoodoo and conjuring. I just had another guest on talking about that, and people don't realize it wasn't just something that was done in the era of slavery. You know, it continued on through the Jim Crow era. And as you mentioned in the book, there's even activists today who are into that specific type of folk magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, hoodoo, conjure, root work, whatever you want to call it, it's a vibrant tradition. Yeah, it definitely did not die in the slavery era. It, as you said, it went through, you know, through Jim Crow all the way up to the current day, when actually, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, as it spread, it was also adopted by white people too. So it's, you know, there's always a concern about appropriation and things like that, which I'm very cautious about. You know, I say in the book, look, I'm not an initiate of any particular magical system. So I don't profess to be that, but I think we live in such an extraordinary time when the scholarship of magic and the availability of to really participate in different systems, to read texts that were, you know, previously never circulated beyond a small group of people or found in libraries, very, you know, special collections, very difficult to get. All this stuff is available to us now. So with this wealth of magical writing and theory, I think that is really part of what's leading this magical renaissance that I see. You know, magic used to, even academically, was kind of, you know, ghettoized. But today there are conferences for it, and there's just great academic research on different magical traditions and books being made available for the first time to the public. And I think what that's doing is it's just opening the toolbox of magic to so many different people and traditions. And that's my style of study. I'm very much a generalist. I've practiced a number of traditions. I've gotten pretty deep in different traditions. But I like to take what works and use what works. Like, you know, it's kind of derided as like a cafeteria style, you know, new age way of practicing. But I don't see it that way. You know, I see we have these wealth of traditions. Why not explore what these traditions have to offer and look for the similarities? You know, my goal in studying magic and practicing it is trying to find sort of the template that underlies a lot of different traditions. And you look at, just for an example, you look at things like mojo bags, you know, wearing something on your person that has things that are special to you or meaningful or magically potent. You find that in you find that in hoodoo and conjure, and that came from Africa. But you also find that going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, Jewish traditions of you know, Jewish tradition of magic. There's, you know, you have a section of the Torah, and you know, it's a magical item. So you wear it on yourself, rolled up in a little scroll case. The Egyptians had that. The Coptic Christians had that. So that's what makes me think, okay, if so many traditions are kind of using the same general technique, maybe that's worth exploring. Maybe there's a reason that so many diverse traditions employ the same kind of techniques.
And I want to get into you know, binding Trump and this stuff as well, but just two more things in regards to this history of the idea of magical resistance, because mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of people, I consider myself a very left of center person, and mm-hmm. a lot of people that are left of the center now sort of have this very materialistic conception. They just sort of see it as new agey, but there's a lot of like left of center characters that were, you know, very much into these magical traditions. And the one that I like most that you bring up is Victoria Woodhull. Could you talk a little bit about her?
Oh yeah. Yeah. She was a spiritualist and a medium. So she, you know, she talked to dead people, to put it very simply. And this was at a time, when this is in 19th century U.S., when spiritualism really gave a voice to women in a way that had not been seen before. I mean, this is a time when doctors would perform clitoridectomies on women who are having hysteria. as they called it. This is a time when women were made to dress a certain way, where they could not speak publicly, where they were supposed to keep their opinions to themselves. And that was the general, you know, that was the general belief. That was a general philosophy. So when spiritualism came along, it was enormous. I mean, it was an enormous religious movement in the U.S. There were seances in the White House and things like that. But Victoria Woodhull was the second woman to address Congress. I thought for a while she was a first, but there was someone else. She ran for president, I believe it was in 1870, on a platform that today would seem radical. It was so far ahead of its time. She was advocating what was then called free love, which was the ability of a woman to marry who she wanted or to not have sex with a man just because he wanted to. You know, it wasn't free love like the 60 cents, although there was, you know, an element of that. But obviously women's suffrage, the right to vote, but it was so much more than that. Like, she wore pants and you know, freaked people out. She promoted vegetarianism. She promoted essentially socialism, free education, free travel without the need for passports, essentially open borders. This woman was amazingly ahead of her time.
Well, she was, her paper was the first paper to publish an English translation of Marx's The Communist Manifesto.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, she was as radical can get. And, you know, she'd be considered radical today if she were running for office. And she even got Frederick Douglass as her VP, even though Douglass was kind of not into it. He was not into spiritualism. I think they just kind of, you know, stuck his name on there. But at the very least, you know, this was a radical feminist running with a black abolitionist in 1870. So it's really kind of astounding. And the whole time, you know, she believed she was channeling, I can't remember the Greek god that the Greek philosopher orator, she was Demosthenes, I think it might have been, that she was channeling. So it all had this kind of magical element to it. And she also, interestingly, she took down, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but she took down Henry Ward Beecher. Yes. Harriet Beecher Stowe's husband, or she was related to him somehow. But yes, he was kind of caught up in an evangelical sex scandal at the time. I mean, he sounds like he was like
a televangelist preacher.
Yeah, he was like a televangelist. Yeah. And like many current televangelists, you know, he liked to have sex outside of his marriage, and she wrote about that, and it caused a huge, you know, huge scandal, which unfortunately a lot of the papers at the time turned against her. And interestingly, they portrayed her as like a devil. They portrayed her as a witch, you know, just because she was so very open in her progressive, you know, liberal socialist sort of beliefs, and the fact that she was attacking this, you know, man of God. So there's so many interesting parallels with today. That was a great find, a really great story, and it could easily and should be a movie. It's such a wild and timely kind of story. So yeah, that was great. I'm glad you mentioned that one. You know, people tend to focus on the witchy stuff, but you know, for my money, that story shows how, you know, spiritual resistance can really have a huge impact.
Right, right. And I mean, it even ties into, you know, later periods now. As you said, she was brandished as, you know, the devil or a witch, you know, mm-hmm. in this negative way. And we see that in the, you know, especially in the 80s with the Satanic Panic, where, you know, the kids who want to explore, you know, D&D or even the kids in the 60s who are into free love, you know, that's all associated with devil worship because it's challenging the status quo. It's challenging patriarchy. It's challenging the way we think about money and capitalism.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the Satanic Panic, certainly I lived through that era. I mean, I was a D&D player and, you know, I had a friend who, you know, there was a church like organizing to shut down his club at his school and things like that. And then, you know, there was the whole Geraldo Rivera, just awful that so many people went to prison, for this like cooked up nonsense. And even, I mean, you look today, you look at things like Pizzagate, which I wrote a big piece on, and, you know, just showing how absolutely ridiculous that conspiracy was. But even that was playing on satanic tropes, you know, and, you know, claiming that Hillary Clinton was, you know, eating children. And I mean, she's been roundly portrayed as a witch too, you know, people like Pat Robertson and things saying she's literally a satanic witch. So, you know, that stuff kind of comes and goes and cycles, and we seem to be in the midst of it again. And, you know, for me, I kind of play with that with, you know, with this whole Trump binding spell. You know, I deliberately put demons in the spell because I knew that would just freak the hell out of the evangelicals, and boy, did it work.
Well, you know, the thing is, it always reminds me of the late Jack Chick, who he, for my listeners that may not know, he wrote these Christian evangelical comics that would attack, you know, all the hippie kids and the Catholics and everyone else as being like a devil worshipper. And the thing was, he wrote one about like Dungeons and Dragons, and he wrote another one about rock and roll and how that was the devil. The thing is, in a way, Jack Chick had all of us pegged right in a certain sense, because what Chick was saying is, oh my God, all these people, they're trying to overthrow the oppressive structures that I like. And that's sort of what we are trying to do. We're trying to overthrow the oppressive structures and have more freedom and more community at the same time. So in a way, they almost have us pegged right in an odd way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you look at, you know, the whole concept of Lucifer, you know, as sort of the light bringer or whatever, and the, you know, the original rebel. That's why, you know, people were seizing upon the fact that I guess Hillary Clinton, you know, like to read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, and it's dedicated to Lucifer. And they're like, oh my God, that just tells you right there, she's a Luciferian devil worshiper. Well, no, it doesn't. You know, I mean, Saul Alinsky recognized the rebellious nature of Lucifer, you know, especially as he's portrayed in Paradise Lost. And, you know, so he's a rebel. So, you know, there is a rebelliousness to, you know, adopting occultism and things like that, like a lot of, you know, people did just to be scary or alternative and things like that. And as far as the Chick publications go, I loved those, man. I loved, you know, going into a phone booth or, you know, a lunch counter and finding one of those sitting there. I thought they were hilarious. And I even wrote a piece. If anybody wants to read it, you could just Google, I think the title is How Dungeons and Dragons Made Me an Occultist, that I wrote about that very topic. And I mean, D&D did kind of introduce me to the idea of magic and occultism and stuff like that. I mean, you look in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and there's, you know, there's sigils and magic circles and talks about summoning demons and stuff like that. And this stuff was fascinating to me as a kid because I was into horror and fantasy and all that stuff. So, you know, I have to say D&D kind of did open my mind to make me interested in occultism and what occultism was. And, you know, it turn me on to some of the terminology, if nothing else. So thanks, Gary Gygax, wherever you are in your ninth circle of hell. You made an occultist. Good job.
Well, the last historical example I want to get into, because his name has come up repeatedly on Parallax Views, and he's a hero of mine, is Abby Hoffman and the Yippies.
Oh, yeah.
So why did you include them in the book?
Yeah, and that again goes back to my idea that magic is a very broad subject, a very broad kind of practice. I mean, I find pranksterish things can have magical effects.
Theater of the absurd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I consider Abby Hoffman a consummate magician. He created enormous change in people's consciousnesses by just doing these radical, outrageous stunts. And the exorcism and levitation of the Pentagon was very much on my mind when I came up with the Trump binding spell. And that was because after the election, and as the presidency started seeing what this presidency was going to mean, all the awful things that were happening, I just thought it felt really surreal. You know, it felt like the singularity was not artificial intelligence becoming conscious or something like that. The singularity felt like this like ridiculous, absurd reality TV buffoon getting elected to the highest office in the land. And reality just felt like it had broken. You know, people talk about it. We're on this shitty timeline, you know, but it really did feel to me like what was up was down, and just everything had broken, and things were happening that were just hard to conceive as really happening. So, but I wanted to do something as a response. And I saw, you know, things like the Women's March and people marching and doing different kinds of actions and things like that. But it didn't feel surreal enough. I felt like the response had to be equally bizarre as the reality that we were suddenly living in. And I couldn't help think back to the exorcism and levitation of the Pentagon, where Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and Allen Ginsberg, they were basically the proto-Yippies. They hadn't quite become the Yippie party yet. When they gathered after a very large march on Washington, D.C., and then they crossed the bridge to the Pentagon. And the idea was to circle the Pentagon and then to perform an exorcism. The band The Fugs led the exorcism, and it was just this goofy amalgamation of different gods and goddesses and calling upon the elements, and it was cheeky, but it was, you know, it was funny. It had an edge of seriousness to it. And so they went to exorcise the demons of the Pentagon and then levitate it. No one saw it rise except maybe the people who on, you know, maybe 250 mics of acid or something like that. But it was a profound cultural prank. It was an event that, you know, it caught people's attention. And, you know, in my mind, it really did sort of alter the course of the public perception of the war. It's where we get the iconic images of people sticking flowers in the, you know, the National Guardsmen rifle barrels and things like that. And they were living in a time where it felt like their reality had shattered. I mean, they're, you know, young kids dying left and right for this enormously stupid war, and Nixon in power. And, you know,
I mean, it was the height of Vietnam. Yeah,
it was the height of Vietnam, you know, but it was also the height of the counterculture. So there was like lots of psychedelics in the mix. So it was really a heady period where lots of, you know, currents were converging. And it was such a beautiful act of resistance and a beautiful prank and a beautiful consciousness altering, you know, middle finger to consensual reality and to the establishment and to the military, that's the act, the kind of action that kept coming back to me when I was thinking, what am I going to do? Like, it has to be something that's going to break all these jaded people. I mean, you can march until your legs are bloody, but that's not going to really register. It will register, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those kind of activities, but I felt like something needed to be done that would break through the jaded news media, that would engage people on a personal level, that would make them go, what? You know, what do you mean, a spell, a ritual? What are you talking about? And so that's why I love what the Yippies did. And there was another group I'll bring up because they're in the book as well. That's WITCH, the acronym WITCH. And they originally called themselves Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. And they sort of were a break off of a radical group, of New York radical group that were kind of modeled after the Yippies, but they were women who were just kind of tired of the normal sort of, activism. So they went out dressed as witches and cursed the patriarchy and they called them zaps. Their actions they called zaps. They did a zap on the stock market is one of their first actions. And the stock market tanked the next day, which was a beautiful synchronicity, if nothing else. And they kind of went away after 1970, but they came back. They came back, after the, I think even before the Trump presidency. And now they're like a regular at protest, these women walking around this traditional witch garb. That kind of thing, I think some people might look at it and say it's silly. You know, really, a lot of activists look at that sort of thing. That's not serious. That's taking away from our energy and what we're trying to do. No, it doesn't. There's room for all kinds of activism. There's room for humor. There's room for, for fun in act. And as a matter of fact, that's the kind of stuff that keeps activists recharged.
And I mean, it also creates a lot of publicity. The levitation of the Pentagon, I don't think Abbie Hoffman necessarily thought they were going to levitate the Pentagon, but it got eyes on the anti-war movement in this country.
Exactly, yeah. It's funny. There's a little anecdote about that. When he got the permit was to levitate the Pentagon 300 feet, and the guy who was issuing the permit said, oh, no. Make it 30 feet and I'll give you the permit. So they actually had a permit to levitate at 30 feet, not 300. That would have been too much. But yeah, it's exactly. And we live in this media sphere, you know, especially more so now that everything's mediated by social media. And, you know, we live in these bubbles and things like that. So in order to get the eyeballs, in order to sort of break people out of their little trance, you really need to do something that's different and that's engaging and that, you know, that it's not, oh, yes, okay, there's another march going on. People are going to tune that. A lot of people are just going to tune that out, even if it's thousands or 10,000 or 100,000 of people. But if you do something like levitate the Pentagon, if you do something like have a bunch of witches hexing Wall Street, if you do something that is a mass organized spell against Donald Trump, that's going to engage people. And even more so, more than engaging them, it's going to like entertain them or make them, if it's something they can take part in, it can make them feel invested in it too. And that was really the goal.
And that leads me to what we've sort of been building to is, you've become very famous for the hashtag magic resistance and the Trump binding ritual, which I guess happened. It started on a midnight on February 24th, 2017. Could you tell us a little bit about that for my listeners that may not be familiar?
Yeah. That it's been the most surreal ride I've ever been on. I'll say that much. Like I was just talking about why I decided to create a spell and a spell that hopefully would engage a lot of people and that people would take up and do. And when I conceived it, I was sitting around with a friend of mine. We're just having some drinks and commiserating and like, what are we going to do? And again, I kept going back to the Pentagon levitation. And I said, it's got to be something wild, like out of left field. And I said, how about a spell? Because I practice magic, so it was natural that I would think, well, it's a spell. And my friend who was with me said, that's the dumbest thing you've ever come up with. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe he's right. Maybe it is kind of dumb. But I couldn't shake it. Like, it kept gnawing at me. So I wrote it. I passed it around to some of my occultist and witchy sort of friends, and they gave me feedback. And I published it on Medium. And I set the date for February 24th of 2017. It was the kind of the last little sliver of the crescent moon. And that's considered in witchcraft and other traditions, like that's a time for binding and for sort of darker forms of magic. So I set that date and I published it on Medium, and then it just blew up. Like within hours, I was kind of like my jaw dropped as I watched the views of this thing go up just from posting it on Medium and you know, posting it on Facebook and Twitter and things like that. It just exploded. And with the next few days, all I did was talk on the phone with like reporters from all over the world. I was on radio shows. And as it got closer to that chosen date, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until in the days leading up to the ritual itself, I was going to do it with some friends. But I didn't want that first ritual to have, you know, Fox News cameras, you know, peering over my shoulder. So I was hesitant to tell media they could film me doing it. I wanted control of that evening. I didn't want it to be basically filmed by anyone else and interrupting and screwing up the vibe and things like that. But so many television people were saying, we want to film people doing this ritual. Where can we go? Where can we go? So I started asking, and there were covens in New York that were doing it. There were people in LA but none of them really wanted to be the focus of the media, and understandably so. I mean, they're lunatics out there. So I eventually said, I just lied. I'm like, I hear there are going to be witches doing it outside of Trump Tower in New York at midnight. Send your camera crews there. And they were like, great, we'll have them out there. And sure enough, the night I did the ritual with about 40 people with a nice fire in a backyard in Baltimore. And after the end of that ritual, we're all just kind of, you know, kind of overcome by the energy of it, and we're like, let's celebrate. A friend of mine walked up to me with his phone. He goes, look at this. And there was video of witches sitting on the sidewalk outside of Trump Tower doing the ritual. So, I mean, it just happened. You know, I published this thing and it just took a life of its own, and it just has just kept going. You know, the ritual was designed to be done every month on the waning crescent moon, and we picked out the exact dates and posted them online. And every month since then, it's been going on. There's a Facebook group. The Facebook group just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's over 3,500 people now. And so it just keeps going, you know, and I think that's a testament to how much people hate this man and hate what he's doing to our country, and will do anything. You know, when the first ritual, so many people I remember saying or commenting, I'm going to do this. Why not? You know, I've tried everything else. I'm just going to do this. I've never done a ritual before. I'm not a witch, but I'm just going to do it. And that actually was a really beautiful and humbling thing that came out of this, is I think this ritual introduced so many people to their own power and their own experience of what they can do when they do something ritualistically themselves. And that was really like that. If nothing else came out of this, I'm just so delighted that a lot of people who might have never thought, oh, I'm going to try to channel my energy through a ritual, actually did that. And so many of them continue to do it and have maybe opened up to using ritual or spells in other aspects or magical thinking in other aspects of their lives. So it was really it's a trip. I really thought initially that maybe, you know, maybe 20 or 30 people might find this interesting, that maybe, you know, a couple dozen might actually do it. But to see it go virally global was just astounding. And I still sometimes I saw that, you know, the copies of the book are starting to ship now, and I'm like holding the book in my hand and going, I can't believe this is actually happening. But it did, you know, we're living in bizarro worlds, so bizarro things can happen.
It sort of brings me to something I really love about the book is it's not we've talked a lot about the history of magical resistance, but it's also sort of it's a guidebook. You even have a magical toolkit section. And one aspect of these rituals that I was wondering if you could get into briefly is this idea of sigil magic, which originates with Austin Osman's spirit, because I've always found that the most compelling, one of the most compelling areas of the occult.
Yeah, I mean, sigil magic was some of the first magic I got into. It was like the 90s, and chaos magic was big on online bulletin boards and things like that, even the pre-web era. So I got really deeply into chaos magic, and one of the main techniques of chaos magic is the creation of sigils. I always found that fascinating because I have a background. I've worked at magazines, I've worked at advertising, and, you know, clearly you look at the power of logos and realize that sigils are, you know, you're really just creating a magical logo in some sense. And there are lots of techniques for creating sigils, but I kind of default to the spare, Austin Osman spare that you talked about. And that's when you take your intention and kind of boil it down to a couple of words. And then you take some people take out the vowels and double letters and things like that. And you take your remaining letters and you fashion them into a symbol. And until it feels magical, until it feels like it just clicks. And then you can charge that symbol in a number of ways. You know, back in the 90s, it was, you know, the joke was, you know, jerking off. And when you orgasm, you charge the symbol when you orgasm. But Spare had something he called the death posture, where he would kind of twist his body in this difficult position and, you know, almost make himself pass out. And when he felt that kind of, you know, alteration in consciousness, then he would charge the sigil. But, it resonated with me a lot because of my background in advertising, and because I know how logos and images and symbols can have deep effects on people. And actually, sigils predate Spare. When you look at, grimoires and things like that, there were all these sorts of ways of making magical sigils. The Golden Dawn had, you know, particular ways of making their own sorts of sigils and things like that, using the Tree of Life or other sorts of esoteric design systems and things like that. But sigil magic, I think, is really powerful. And it's one of those techniques. There was also, I happened to be at a conference called the Disinfo Conference in the year 2000 in New York City. And that's when Grant Morrison did a really famous talk on sigil magic, and that just kind of blew that video has been watched like a million times or something. And it really blew sigil magic into the, you know, larger consciousness of a lot of people. It was a great presentation. If anyone listening has never seen it, just Google it. It's fascinating. And he does a really good job explaining sigil magic and how it works. But so I designed a Trump binding sigil because I think it's very useful when you do magic to have a symbol, you know, as a means of concentration, the same way that Tibetan Buddhists will have a mandala or the yantra or something to focus their attention on to alter consciousness. So this sigil, I thought, you know, I took a lot of time and I tweaked it and worked it, and then you just kind of know when it clicks that it's right, and no more, you know, futzing around with it is actually going to make it better. So this really felt like it clicked for me. And then I started using it as my avatar, and all of a sudden all sorts of other people used it as their avatar, and it just spread among the people doing this binding spell. And, you know, the ideas that a sigil, the more, at least my conception, other people might disagree, but it's just like a logo. You know, the more people see it, the more it affects their consciousness, even if they're not quite sure what it is. It's changing their consciousness. So this sigil, having people use this as their avatar and seeing it spread and using it, like every time someone in the Trump administration is like loses their job, I take their face and I Photoshop a little sigil like right above their third eye and things like that. So it's become this little shorthand for the Trump binding. And it got to the point where like, people were like, man, I want a t-shirt with this, you know, can I get a hoodie? And I went and made a little 3D model and made myself a pendant that I wear when I do the ritual. And people started asking for them too. So I set up a little, you know, Shapeways shop to sell these sigils. People wanted them. And so it's just so cool that this little symbol, you know, it encapsulates the whole binding spell. It, you know, it's like symbols are a simple image that encapsulate, or they carry a larger message. And that's what the sigil has done. It's been really effective and, you know, really adopted by so many people. So to me, it feels like it's a really powerful example of sigil magic when it's kind of let loose in the world, and it just kind of again has like the spell sort of did, it has a life of its own. You know, I just feel like I just kind of birthed something like this, and then it's just out there doing its own thing.
Well, it's what I've always liked about sigil magic and my understanding of it is you're putting all this energy into this ritual of making this symbol, and you're putting all this concentration into it, so that then after you're done with the ritual and creating the sigil, I think there's something about doing that allows you to go out into the world and then try to make your intentions, which is what you're charging the sigil with in sigil magic. You're trying to make those intentions a reality then.
Exactly, yeah. And there are some schools of sigil magic where you once you create the sigil, you destroy it, you burn it, or, you know, burning usually, or somehow bury it or somehow destroy it, because the idea is then it works in your subconscious, or it works below the level of your thinking to sort of manifest its effect. I think that's legitimate. I've done sigil magic that way. But when I combine sigil magic with my understanding of advertising and marketing and the power of logos and the power of symbols and images, I think especially for something like this Trump spell, which is a very public piece of magic anyway, it's not a private, it's meant to be public. And that, you know, that I got a lot of flack from a lot of magicians and witches for that, because, you know, there's a train of thought that, oh, you have to keep magic really dark and private, and if you let anyone know, it spoils it. Well, again, I don't believe that. I think things like the Pentagon exorcism and levitation are very powerful outward, you know, public forms of magic, theater. And so in this case, this sigil carries with it. And it's funny because people will see it and say, what is that? You know, like, so they'll see it, like a lot of people using it as their avatar, Facebook or Instagram or whatever. Someone will see it. What is that? Yeah, it's interesting. And then they find out what it is. So it's a way of propagating the spell also, or people's awareness of the spell too, because it is an arresting image and it doesn't look like anything else. So it has its own charge and its own meaning, and that gets communicated, you know, as it spreads and perpetuates. So yeah, I mean, this is I highly encourage people, if you never try any form of magic at all, if you think it's just, you know, total horseshit, try making a sigil. Try exploring that, because it, you know, it's for me, it was the very first magical technique that actually like knocked my socks off. And so I think if you want to like get your feet wet, try sigil magic. Just look up online how to do it. There's all different varieties and techniques, but it's a really powerful technique.
And I know we're running up against the hour mark here, but there's one last thing I wanted to get into briefly, if we could.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different spells and rituals you have in the book, and there's one that I wanted to highlight because it seems apropos. It's called the Hex the NRA ritual, and it, you know, maybe a lot of people have been doing that because the NRA has been falling on hard times lately.
Yeah, that was the second major ritual that I published online. It's in the book as well, and I'm going to look it up so I have it there. There's also, by the way, there's for those who are alarmed by the increase in fascists in our country, there's a fuck fascist spell that I'm quite fond of too, and that comes the closest to really like malign magic. It's a witch jar or a spell jar magic that really is intended to, you know, to really kind of stop these people, and it's whether, you know, whether or not it eventually turns out to harm them or not. Honestly, you know, in the age of, you know, should I punch a Nazi or not? I think if you're afraid of hexing a Nazi, then, you know, I think you might be a little too timid. But the Hex the NRA spell, that I published after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the Parkland shooting. And I was just sick. You know, it's the day all these kids are mown down, and that's the day that the NRA decides to tweet like a Valentine's Day, like a little heart-shaped cushion with a, you know, with an automatic, semi-automatic pistol sitting on it, as their Valentine's Day tweet. And I was sick, man. I was just done, you know. I mean, I'm not against gun ownership or anything like that. I thought, you know, I believe the Second Amendment protects people's right to have guns. But the NRA is not about protecting people's rights for guns, to possess guns. I mean, if you look at their videos, they're just coming out as this utterly reactionary, right-wing, fascist, promotional organization. You know, I mean, they're pushing the...
They released that video recently where Donna Loesch was saying, we're going to fight back. And it's like, you know, they're making an encouragement to violence. Yeah.
Yeah. They're encouraging violent insurrection, and they're pinpointing people like Antifa and Black Lives Matter as terrorists or something like that. So, I mean, you're essentially calling for people to kill my people, you know, and I'm sorry. You're not a gun safety organization if you're doing – you're not teaching gun safety. You're encouraging armed insurrection against my people. So sorry. You know, I'm going to do everything in my power to shut you down. And that's what the Hex the NRA spell was all about. And it incorporates a dollar bill, which as part of the ritual, it's painted red. And blood money is written on the dollar bill. It uses kind of a typical sort of a conjure hoodoo style of spell against the NRA. And after it's done, And also the NRA logo is used because we were talking about sigils. I think logos are really powerful. So a really powerful, potent psalm is written over top of a printout of the NRA logo. And then you take that, dollar bill, you roll it up after you've burned a black candle and recited the spell, which is pretty dark, you know? I mean, but again, I'm not for cursing individual people. I don't believe in using, my ethics for magic is I wouldn't do anything magically that I wouldn't do personally. So I wouldn't shove Wayne LaPierre in front of a bus or anything like that. But would I hurt the organization? Would I try to harm the organization? Hell yeah. So it's targeted directly at the organization. It's very potent. It's a very vicious spell, but it's very much geared towards stopping them and what they're doing. And once you take that logo that you've written the psalm over and the dollar bill with blood money, it has a nice element that I think adds the activist portion of it. You take that, you put it in an envelope addressed to the NRA. And then you write the name of a shooting victim as the return address, and you send that off to the NRA. And yeah, it's fascinating because, you know, I published this spell. I knew some people were doing it. There's a documentary filmmaker that filmed someone in DC doing it. I haven't actually seen that yet, but that caught fire, literally, pretty widely. Not as much as the Trump spell, but then it has been fascinating to see that what's happening to the NRA with this, you know, this crazy, you know, Russian woman who is, you know, who seemed to be, you know, working with Russian intelligence, maybe getting herself into the NRA, into the top echelons of the NRA. There's been shakeups and things like that. They're very, very quiet about this woman. And they were recently saying, you know, they're losing money, which you never know if that's just a way for them to try to fundraise or if it's true. But they've definitely, you know, they've taken a bit of a dive. You know, there's been a lot of attention on perhaps where their actual money was coming from. And the students who have organized against them are really doing a fantastic job of mobilizing people and getting people to register to vote. So it's, you know, again, you know, people always ask, is the Trump spell working or is the NRA spell working? Well, you know, magic is not that easy to quantify. It's a lot of it happens synchronistically or serendipitously. You often can't say, well, this spell actually made this happen. But hey, in the long run, if the results are going in your direction, I say that's a pretty good indication that it might be working. And with the one thing I've been telling people when they ask if the Trump spell is working, like, what is this guy constantly tweeting about? The witch hunt, right? I mean, every day, this witch hunt, the witch hunt. When are they going to stop the witch hunt against me? I find it so interesting that phrase is such – it's like so embedded in his head. You know, it's almost like this spell we're doing somehow colonized a part of his brain and he can't stop thinking in metaphors of a witch hunt. You know, like somehow we got in there and the way it's expressing it is through his constant use of the term witch hunt, the metaphor of a witch hunt. So it's, does it work? Is it working? That's always the question. I'd have to say the resistance that has been generated against this president is unlike anything I've ever seen. And I've been an activist since the Reagan era. You know, I was a no-nuker, U.S. out of Central America, you know, all the way up to the present. I've never seen anything like the mobilization against this president. So I always like to add, even if you don't believe in magic, even if you think it's the biggest pile of nonsense, doing this spell can actually make you feel better And there's nothing wrong with feeling better. And the spell was designed to be what I call a self-exorcism, because I, like many people, was feeling overwhelmed by the 24/7 news cycle, the barrage of horror, you know, everything from, you know, dumping coal slag into mountain streams to like the dismantling of the EPA, the Muslim ban, and, you know, now throwing, you know, pulling children away from their parents, throwing them in cages, drugging them, and leaving them in situations where they could be sexually abused. I mean, it's enough to burn anyone out. Anyone who has like a shred of decency or concern about what's happening in their world is just beaten to a pulp by this unrelenting fire hose of shit spraying in our faces from Washington nowadays. So what the spell is designed to do is like help you at least feel like you've gotten your power back. And even after the first binding, that's the thing I remember so many people saying, like, look, I feel so much better now. Like this, like I haven't felt this way in ages. You know, I don't know whether it's actually doing anything or not, but I feel better. Like I've got my power back from this nightmarish scenario, this nightmarish administration and this person. And that's, even if it does that, even if that's all it does, I think that's real magic right there. And so, you know, I am happy that people that don't believe in magic are doing this, atheists, agnostics, you know, people doing it as a lark or whatever, because a lot of them are like, whoa, you know, doing a ritual in which I basically assert the things I believe in and condemn the things that I am absolutely against, that I think are harming me and harming others, harming the planet, harming our society. It's a beautiful thing. You know, it's a beautiful thing to affirm on a regular basis your principles and to affirm your resistance against things that are antithetical to those principles.
Well, it's almost like I've always viewed it almost as a it's like a very powerful form of psychodrama in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And psychodrama is magic. Magic is psychodrama. Magic is theater. It's art. And that's why, you know, these knucklehead, you know, magicians, you know, ceremonial magicians telling me, well, you, that's not the way to do it. You know, you're leading people into, you know, danger, and, you know, these Wiccans who are like, oh, but the threefold law says you cannot do harmful magic or it comes back to you threefold. First of all, I'm not a Wiccan. I respect Wicca and, you know, the large portion of the people who are doing this Trump binding spell are witches, and it became witches versus Trump because people don't understand magic is more than witches. But I practiced witchcraft for a while. It's a beautiful system. But I'm not a witch, so this threefold law doesn't apply to me. The ceremonial magician guys, some even very, you know, famous people in the field, you know, who are just like slagging me because you don't do magic in the open, you do magic in secret. Shut up, you know? I mean, magic is the yippies, you know, throwing money you know, on the down the floor of the stock market,
the New York Stock Exchange,
right? The stock exchange, right? It's the levitation of the Pentagon. It's these women dressed as witches out, you know, at the Women's March. It is, magic is like a powerful musician, you know, driving a crowd into a frenzy. Magic is bigger than just, you know, stuff you do with candles and wands in your basement. It's, you know, but that's my broad understanding of magic. Magic causes change. It can cause, you know, the old adage, the Dione Fortune, and then taken by Crowley and others. Magic is the art of changing consciousness in accordance with will. And then, you know, people that believe in magic in the objective world, you know, they believe that change of consciousness can change things in the, you know, the outer world as well. But I think magic is something that causes change. It can be, you know, it could be John and Yoko's bed in for peace. It could be, again, the levitation of the Pentagon. It can be Bob Dylan, performing a song that changes people's consciousness. It could be a rave, you know. It could be electronic music.
The one I always think of is I don't know if you're familiar with the band the KLF from the 80s. They did I love the thing they did where they took like a bunch of money and they just burned it.
Yeah, they were great. I mean, they were chaos magicians, you know. I mean, and Psychic TV, you know, another.
I love Genesis P. Orridge.
Yeah, yeah.
Genesis Prior P. Orridge.
Yeah, so. You know, that's how I see magic, not as this, you know, thing you have to be initiated in and go up in the ranks and things like that. I mean, anyone can do something powerful and magical. So it's a really broad thing for me. If it causes change in people's consciousness on a big scale, if it's an act that creates some kind of change that just ripples through society. It's magic to me. So, you know, the criticism of the stuff I'm doing, the stuff I write about in the book, it's inevitable because magicians and witches, like anyone else, they get stuck in their little, you know, their rut or their dogma, and anything outside of that becomes threatening to them. I'm happy if you want to practice magic your way, but don't tell me how to do my magic. Don't define my magic for me, because my magic embraces all sorts of actions, all sorts of art, all sorts of happenings and theater and writing. You know, writing, I write fiction too. And that's some of the most intense magic that we don't, you know, we're so used to it. We don't realize how amazing that is. Like, I write a book and I'm sitting there creating this fictional story. And then 10 years later, you're sitting reading the story I created and it's happening in your head, you know, only a different way through these little black squiggles on paper. You know, that's some amazing magic. But we don't think of it that way because, you know, that's maybe the most potent magical technology that exists is the written word. And, you know, it's just invisible to us because we're swimming in it all day. But that still boggles my mind that, you know, I'm reading Dickens, you know, many, many, many years after he wrote something, and his story is coming alive in my head. You know, it's like telepathy through time and space. It's so, you know, let's open the definition of magic wider, and let's not, you know, ghettoize it to the people who are, you know, quote, magicians, you know, who are serious about this stuff. I think everybody should try magic. Everybody should try ritual. Everybody should think magically. I mean, not to the point where you're a slobbering New Ager, you know, who will believe any channeled crap, you know, that comes out of someone's mouth, but let's try to embrace the forms of magical thinking that make our lives better, that make us happier, that help us change things for the better and empower ourselves and, you know, and make society better. Let's embrace that, you know, let's that's what this book is about. It's about like finding your own way to share your personal power in ways that lift people up instead of like stomping down on them with your boot heel, which unfortunately, you know, is that there's just too much of that right now.
Well, it gets into the whole thing of punching up rather than punching down.
Exactly. And not even punching all the time, you know, I mean, it's
right.
Just like lifting up. Yeah, you know, that thing you do when you're kids, when you put your fingers under someone and light as a feather, you know, I think that's some people's first experience of like, holy crap, you know, like mind over matter, magic. And that's a metaphor I like to think of, like, let's magically lift people up. Yes, a lot of this, the book is called Magic for the Resistance, so a lot of it is about resisting. It's about pushing back the toxic mind virus, the global toxic mind virus that is fascism, that is racial supremacy, that is like this hyper capitalist punching down on people. So, you know, Nazis, yeah, we got to resist them. You know, we can't just let them, you know, do their thing. It's important to push back. It's important to push back, you know, when our globe is experiencing these, you know, these crises of climate that are going to affect my children and my children's children. You know, there's a lot to push back against. There's a lot to resist, but there's also a lot in the book too about lifting people up, you know, LGBTQ people, lifting the marginalized people, immigrants who are being, you know, thrown in cages, things like that. You know, we need to help, you know, if we're going to pull through what I see as like these looming existential crises, particularly environmental, we really got to get our shit together. And the way we do that is to kind of stop and take stock of where we are and who we want to be and the kind of ideals and principles that we want to embrace and the stuff that we have to cut out, the cancerous stuff that has got us where we are on this precipice. You know, I mean, I really do feel like this generation, we're kind of the, you know, where it's either we're going to make it or we're going to break it. And I really believe that it's what we need is a spiritual awakening. And for so long, the left has been kind of caricatured as just this, you know, completely atheistic, materialistic, you know, Marxist, left. You know, that's the caricature of it. But you look back even to the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War, they were led by, you know, I mean, Martin Luther King was a serious Christian. There were Christians and Jews in the front lines of the civil rights struggle. So the left does not have to be materialistic left. It doesn't have to be a-spiritual. The left can embrace spirituality, you know, even if it's kind of a non-traditional, you know, religious spirituality. And I think that has to happen.
I was going to say, you can embrace material analyses too and see how people are oppressed based on class, race, and gender, but you can also embrace spirituality. You know, it doesn't have to be an either or.
No, it has to be both, actually. I think if we're going to fix things, we have to find some kind of spiritual element, even if it's not a religious spiritual element. I mean, there's plenty of great thinkers of spirituality and you know, non-dogmatic spiritual people and none of the above kind of spiritual people. In fact, that's the, you know, spiritual but not religious is like the largest growing category of people, especially millennials are embracing, well, you know, I'm not going to church because, you know, that's ridiculous. And the church my parents were brought up in is absurd and it's, you know, it's anachronistic and it makes no sense to me. But I do feel like there's a spiritual element to my life. So I might not be religious, but I can still embrace, you know, even if it's on a connection to nature or something like that. And I think that's critical. And that's critical because religion and politics, when you say that, people think of the right wing. Because, you know, since Reagan and the marriage of the Republican Party and toxic fundamentalist Christianity, that's guided the right wing, and they've embraced it, and it empowers what they do. I mean, all these church going people, they're feeling it, you know, when they're taking your gay friend and trying to convert him, they're feeling it because they got Jesus in them. You know, this is not just, it's, you know, this is not just a philosophical thing. This is religious to them. Or abortion, you know, this is, they're saving all those baby souls and things like that. So that gives them an edge. You know, that gives them an edge that the left doesn't have. And that's why I think books, you know, the stuff that I'm writing about and people, you know, marrying their spirituality to progressive causes. And the progressive stuff is actually the Christians, you know, is the real Jesus stuff. If you look back at, if you just read, you know, if you get your one of the old red word Bibles and read what Jesus said, I mean, what amazes me is like in this topsy-turvy world, like the witches who are binding Trump are the ones who are embracing the Christian, you know, the formerly Christian beliefs of compassion and tolerance and helping people and not judging people and stuff like that. So, you know, that it blows my mind, but it's, you know, it's the pagan community and the witch community that's carrying these real humanitarian ideals and the ideals of justice and like compassion and extending our circle of compassion to like other beings on the planet and the, you know, the biosphere itself and things like that, where you've got this sick, wicked Christian dominionist belief that, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, if we pollute the hell out of the earth, because Jesus is going to come and clean it all up.
It's so bizarre too, because I mean, you have the quote by Jesus where he says, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Yeah. You know, I always loved, Jello Biafra had a song with one of his bands called Jesus Was an Anarchist.
I love Jello, man. That was my era of music too. But yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, the mega churches and these guys and they're, you know, it's insane. I mean, how inverted things have become. But to get back to the point, you know, I think the left, the progressive people, you know, there's plenty of progressive Christians. There's plenty of progressive Jews. There's progressive Buddhists and progressive Muslims and things like that. But, you know, it's this group of people who don't feel like they fit in with organized religion, who are trying to find their own way. They're the ones that I think are going to, you know, embrace sort of this new form of spirituality that's more inclusive, that's non-dogmatic, that really, you know, is open and embraces all sorts of different communities. And the pagan community has been like right there, and they've been there for a long time. You know, Starhawk, famous witch, you know, kind of incorporated activism. She's also written about in the book, and like feminist witchcraft. And she was out, you know, doing sit-ins to block the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in the 80s and combining her spiritual tradition with that. And, you know, so it's like, that's what I think we need. And that's why like the Trump spell and the magic resistance has gotten so much traction, because so many people, feel, you know, want to be active, and they see the things that they care about being dismantled and crushed, under these new toxic mind viruses, which is what I think they are. And not just in the US, but in Europe too, these resurgent nationalistic parties, you know, in Russia, all over Europe. These nationalistic, autocratic, you know, anti-immigrant parties are really taking off. And it's a mind virus. It's rooted in a specific kind of spiritual outlook for a lot of them, this battle of Christianity against Islam, this crusader mentality. So what I think people on the left are like, well, we have spiritual beliefs too. And our beliefs are completely antithetical to what you sickos are out there pimping and pushing. And we want to change things too. So now we're going to channel our spirituality into our activism. And I just think it's a beautiful thing. I can only take a tiny bit of credit for this. Like, I feel like the Trump binding spell, it was a seed that fell into fertile ground. You know, like I just kind of birthed it. And I felt like it was the right thing at the right time, but people were ready for something like this. There, other people were doing similar things too. So it feels like this is kind of the zeitgeist, you know, like let's channel our, you know, our deepest core beliefs, our spirituality, our practices into, you know, making the world a better place. I mean, it's corny. But when you're facing the onslaught of this wickedness, that's just trying to hammer us all down, we got to do it.
And you know, I'm going to say, I don't think it's corny. I think, you know, I think we need to get past this, you know, this stage that a lot of Gen Xers that I know have had, you know, since the 90s of like, cynicism is cool. That's why I like Magic for the Resistance, because to me it's not just Magic for the Resistance. You could have called it Magic for the People. That's an alternate title.
I like that. Yeah, it's, you know, the cynicism. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm very, you know, I'm jaded in a lot of ways. So I understand the cynicism. And even when it's not just an affect to look cool or whatever the case, like, I understand cynicism. I mean, it's easy to be jaded. It's also easy to tune out and say, I hate politics, you know. Well, I just don't care about this stuff. I mean, you can spend, you know, you can play Grand Theft Auto and, you know, have your consciousness spend a good chunk of your life in that kind of, you know, simulated reality. It's easier than ever nowadays to just tune politics out, you know, tune what's happening socially and politically out and, you know, say, yeah, screw it, man. You know, I'm going to play a game. I'm going to binge something on Netflix. You know, I'm going to just, you know, goof around online or whatever. There's so many distractions, and activism sucks sometimes. You know, it's not fun. It's work. It's a pain in the ass, you know, calling your senators, the daily, you know, canvassing, doing get out the vote and stuff like that. It's not meant for everybody. It's hard work. It sucks. You lose a lot. It's frustrating as hell. But, you know, what are you going to do, man?
It's like all the, there's all these studies I've seen that show that, you know, people who live hedonistically a lot of times actually are not as happy as people who live for a type of communal meaning. You know, it's odd. You would think it would be the opposite, right? But
often it
isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's meaning. It's finding meaning in our lives. And one of the easiest ways to find meaning is just to embrace something, you know, a cause. And sometimes it just comes to people when it has to, you know, like if you're living in Flint, Michigan, and you've got two kids and you find out they've been drinking poison water, that can make you an activist pretty damn quickly and make you very passionate activist because it's something you care about. But there are some people like myself that just, you know, it's just part of who we are, our makeup. Like we feel compelled to try to right things that are wrong and make things better. And, you know, there are times when I live hedonistically too. And I write about that in the book too. I mean, you have to have a balance in your life.
Self-care.
Or you will burn yourself out. Like, no one likes someone who can just talk about one issue. You know, the militant vegan who can only talk about veganism, or, you know, the Marxist guy, you know, who, you know, can only talk about Marxism and, you know, the destruction of capitalism through that particular prism. And, you know, you need to balance your life with things, with joyful things, things you enjoy, friends, and things like that. But activism is important. And I think a lot of people were shaken out of their complacency by the election of Donald Trump, because, you know, it's easy. You know, you got Obama and you know, he's a great, wonderful speaker, and he looks great and he makes you feel good. So maybe you're not that concerned that he's dropping bombs, you know, and killing kids in other countries and stuff like that. It's easy just to not think about all that stuff. But Donald Trump comes along and you see the dismantling of the EPA. You see kids being thrown in cages. You see, you know, him calling women dogs. You just see the utter disgraceful and just this pilfering that all of his, you know, all his administration is doing, sucking money out of, you know, tax money into their own private accounts and things like that. You know, the whole Russian stuff. I mean, even if I know a lot of lefties are like, I love that Russian crap's just nonsense. You know, I don't think it's nonsense. I think you can't look at the guy, you know, standing up next to Putin like a coward dog, you know, giving away the store and not think there's something to this, you know, to whatever extent it is. This is shaking people up. This is not ordinary. People are going, well, wait a minute. You know, there's, you know, it's made people like my mom an activist. You know, it's made people that never would have thought I'm going to put on my shoes and go out and march with a sign in my hand. And that's good because it has to happen because things are breaking. It's breaking down so quickly that it is an emergency. I mean, it's like all hands on deck, people. This is not the time to tune out. And this is the time to really shut down this shit show because this could be a really, really major turning point in our lives. If we don't shut this down, I don't know what's going to happen.
And to close out, I always like to leave on a positive note. I have a lot of listeners in New York that are really excited about the run of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of the DSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any magical advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a candidate that you're really pulling for, there is a spell in the book that I can't find the name of it right now, but it's basically like
candidate boosting spell.
Yeah, it's like a way to boost your candidate. And again, even if you don't believe that kind of thing can have any effect, try it anyway. I mean, it's a really powerful way to, you know, to kind of state and verbalize and feel your commitment to that candidate. And I will also say, I am currently working on, and this will probably come out in the next few weeks. I'm not sure where, but a general blue wave spell, that people can employ, regularly and then especially again on election day. And so I'm going to release that because I think that's something, you know, unless you're like a really jaded, lefty who, you know, thinks every Democrat is a sellout, or you just can't, you know, bring yourself to vote for a corporate candidate or whatever. You know, again, this is an emergency situation. The alarm bells are going off. The smoke's coming out. You know, the smoke detector is blaring. Let's just shut these clowns down and get them out. And then we can talk about, like, you know, fixing our candidates so they're more progressive and dumping some of these blue dog Democrats. Let's just focus on the emergency. Okay. So the blue wave spell, I hope, will be shared and embraced, not as, you know, an endorsement of everyone in the Democratic Party, but shutting this shit show down, getting rid of the GOP, marginalizing them like they should be, changing Congress. So then, you know, once we put out the fires, let's start making a more progressive, you know, a more powerful Democratic Party that represents people. And let's, but right now, let's put out the fire. Okay. Let's put out the fire and then let's organize.
And I think we're going to, I honestly believe this. People online have always thought of me as a pessimist, but I'm trying to be more optimistic these days. And I think we're going to put out the fire. I think we're going to get things like Medicare for All. I think we're really going to do it. And I think books like yours and the work you're doing are going a long way in, changing people's attitudes towards, you know, just how they approach the world and how they approach politics and community.
I hope so. You know, for me, politics is a personal thing. You know, it's not like a section of my life. It is my life. You know, it's things I care about. It's people I care about. It's my gay friends. It's my, you know, it's my African American friends, my, you know, the immigrant people that I know that I've worked with, that I care about. And it's about, you know, it's about the air that we're breathing and the water and the fact that, you know, the climate is so rapidly changing that we're hitting uncharted territory. So it's not politics. It's life, you know, it's life. And you have to embrace life and you have to try to help other people and not just yourself, because that's where you find meaning, like you were saying earlier. So this book is about politics. There's a, you know, but it's not politics. It's just about, it's about transformation. And as you, the beauty of it that I've learned over the years, and it's embedded in every religion or spiritual tradition, is that when you try to help other people, when you try to make things a little better, when you try to fix things and, you know, and help someone who's hungry or sick or persecuted, it makes you feel better. I mean, you know, you can look at actual studies that show that. That's not just, you know, masturbatory philosophizing. It's real, and there's data backing that up. So and once people do it, they realize it. You know, once you get out there and you do something and you try to make things better, even if you lose, even if you keep losing, it fortifies your soul. And that's what I hope this book does. That's what I hope, you know, that's the positive thing that's happening, that, you know, Donald Trump may be doing the world the greatest favor we've ever had, the favor that we need of waking us up.
He lit a fire up under our ass.
He lit a fire. I mean, my ass is crispy right now, you know, but it's but the fire, we need to keep that fire burning. And, you know, so I appreciate shows like yourself and letting people like me come on and talk about this crazy witchcraft for social change. And, you know, I'm an optimist, too. I have to be an optimist.
Hey, you just got mentioned in Publishers Weekly, I think, yeah, too. So yeah, it's getting out there, folks.
It's getting out there. Yeah, I have to be an optimist, too. I have kids. You know, I have two daughters, tweens. And, you know, the thought of leaving them, if the way things are going politically and socially in the U.S. and around the world, like, I don't want to leave them with that crap that my generation has allowed to happen, and my parents' generation. So, you know, I want to leave them a chance, of having a fulfilling life. And you know, so that's why I'm doing this. I hope lots of people feel that way. I think a lot of people are waking up, and this transformation, this idea of, you know, bringing your spiritual self to your activism, to your work, to make things better. I just hope that's the virus. Like, that's the mind virus that I hope spreads, instead of this, you know, this toxic fascism that is really spreading a little too widely for my taste.
Well, I want to thank you again, Michael M. Hughes, for coming on Parallax Views to talk about magic for the resistance, rituals, and spells for change.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Love your show. And man, I'm just delighted to be here. So thanks for having me on.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed that conversation from the Parallax Views back catalog of Michael M. Hughes, author of Magic for the Resistance, Rituals and Spells for Change. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy.
So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.